When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Good evening, everyone. We'll begin the readout tonight with the clear and present danger that has not subsided since the MAGA insurrection. Today, the acting chief of the Capitol Police, Yogananda Pittman, had a frankly terrifying warning about the threat posed by the right-wing extremists inflamed by the disgraced former president's lies about the election, who then laid siege to the Capitol on January 6th.
We know that members of the militia groups that were present on January 6th have stated their desires that they want to blow up the Capitol and kill as many members as possible with a direct nexus to the State of the Union, which we know that date has not been identified.
In a House hearing on security failures during the riot, Chief Pittman said that that very threat is the reason security remains elevated around the Capitol nearly 2 months later. She told lawmakers that Capitol Police didn't ignore intelligence about the risk of violence, but said the intelligence that had been gathered offered no credible threat about the size of the riot. She was also asked about an FBI report sent to the Capitol Police the night before all hell broke loose, which warned of war at the Capitol on January 6th and noted, quote, an online thread discussed specific calls for violence, stating, be ready to fight. Congress needs to hear glass breaking, doors being kicked in, and blood from their BLM, meaning Black Lives Matter, and Antifa slave soldiers being spilled. Get violent, unquote. Chief Pittman acknowledged the police did receive that assessment, but incredibly, it wasn't forwarded up the chain.
It was shared with task force agents that are embedded from Capitol Police with the FBI. They, in turn, sent their email that they received to a lieutenant within the protective and intelligence operations side of the house. That information was not then forwarded any further up the chain. So that is a lesson learned for U.S. Capitol Police.
Meanwhile, we learn new details about the scope of the attack. An estimated 10,000 attendees of the rally leading to the siege descended on the Capitol grounds, and about 800 made their way into the building. That's all the more reason why House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is pushing forward with a 9/11 style commission into the insurrection. And true to form, the two top Republicans in Congress who stood by the disgraced former president's big lie leading up to the attack on the Capitol, even though they both have acknowledged he was responsible for it, are trying to obstruct that full accounting, saying it's unfair to Republicans.
It seems most of this is politically driven, and it seems like she's setting up a system to fail.
Speaker Pelosi started by proposing a commission that would be partisan by design. An inquiry with a hardwired partisan slant would never be legitimate in the eyes of the American people.
Before retreating into his shell, Mitch McConnell said the commission should also look at violent extremism from the left, which is about as deranged as Wisconsin Republican Senator Moscow Ron Johnson pushing a conspiracy theory earlier this week that fake Trump supporters are behind the riot and that, well, real Trump supporters were too overweight and too busy carrying their grandkids with them to the Capitol to possibly be the culprits. Speaker Pelosi said today that she was disappointed in the Senate minority leader.
I had the impression that he wanted to have a January 6th, similar to 9/11, commission. It seemed when he spoke that he was taking a page out of the book of Senator Johnson.
Meanwhile, while Republicans are desperately trying to move on from the terror of January 6th and the lingering threat of domestic white nationalist terrorism, the Biden administration is tackling it head on. In an op-ed in The Washington Post, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas wrote, For several years, the United States has been suffering an upsurge in domestic violent extremism. The horror of seeing the U.S. Capitol, one of the pillars of our democracy, attacked on January 6th, was a brutal example of our suffering, and it compels us all to action. Emphasis on all. Joining me now is Congressman Joe Neguse of Colorado, a member of the Judiciary Committee and an impeachment manager in the recent trial. Elizabeth Newman, former Assistant Secretary for Threat Prevention and Security Policy in the Department of Homeland Security. And Michael Steele, former chair of the Republican National Committee. Thank you all for being here. And Congressman Neguse, I want to start with you. If the leaders of the Republican House and Senate, the Republican caucuses in the House and Senate, believe that that having a 9/11 style commission would be unfair to Republicans, that implies that they either understand that Republicans were involved or complicit, and that they understand that if you unfold all that happened, it will implicate Republicans. I point you to one of your, I'll say colleagues in air quotes, since she's just a troll most of the time, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon supporter. One of her friends has now refuted her claim and other claims by Republicans that it was Antifa that was really to blame for the siege. He was on tape saying, no, it was us. It was totally us. I was there. I was part of it. Do you think that what is concerning Republicans in either chamber is that they'll get caught out if there was a 9/11 style commission?
Well, it's good to be with you, Joy. I'm not going to speak for the Republicans. I'll just simply say it's confounding. I don't understand their opposition to the reasonable proposal that the speaker has made in terms of having a blue ribbon commission, particularly after the very startling testimony that we heard today from the acting chief, which you played in part. I would hope that every member of Congress would want to have a commission take an objective look at the facts and ensure that we're taking the appropriate security precautions here at the Capitol complex, given what the acting police chief testified to today. But as I said, I don't know that I'm going to get into the business of trying to explain the rationale of the colleague that you mentioned, or any of the others for that matter.
Well, you know, but I will allow them to explain themselves. So this is Cut Six. I'm jumping a bit for my producers. This is Mitch McConnell. This is what Mitch McConnell said in response to your, sir, and your fellow impeachment manager's case. Here was Mitch McConnell's conclusion after he voted to acquit the former president. Here he is.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day.
Same question then to you, Elizabeth Newman. You were in the business of dealing with Homeland Security when you were in the former administration. If you were investigating this case on a commission, a 9/11 style commission, wouldn't you have to look at the former president, who Mitch McConnell himself blamed for the attack, and look at other Republicans who were involved in inciting that riot?
I am a staunch believer in a fully bipartisan, objective review of what all of the factors that led to January 6th. But I actually think we need to go broader. And I've been calling for there to be a 9/11-like commission for over a year. I testified before Congress a year ago this week and said the federal government does not have the tools that we need to be able to go after this threat. It is very difficult for us to do this in the executive branch or the legislative branch. It's highly political to look into what kind of tools we might need to best address the threat. And I warned them that we were on the precipice of some event that ended up manifesting as January 6th. And here we are on the other side, sadly now needing to investigate what actually happened on January 6th, which is very important. But if we don't go back and look at the broader trends, the disinformation, which Donald Trump absolutely took advantage of, but he did not create, if we don't look at the rise of violent white supremacy that's been happening for a decade, if we don't look at the problem of militias that have been happening well outside of January 6th, then we're going to miss the point. So we need to have a broad look at all of those factors in order to get to the right recommendations of what we need to do as a government and as a society to combat the threat. And I'll just say one other thing with regards to Mitch McConnell's suggestion that we need to look at all violent extremism. I say the Democrats should take him up on that, because the facts are going to bear out that the threat is coming from what we call violent right-wing extremism. It's not coming from the left. But we should, in the name of creating that bipartisan feel, if that's what the right wants to look at, let's let that be part of the scope.
Yeah, bring it. I challenge them to find 1,000 Antifa, since apparently they think they're living under everyone's beds. You know, let me play, because the other issue is, Michael, that if there was an honest and thoroughgoing accounting of what brought us here, there would be a requirement to look into what amounts to parts of the right-wing base, of the Republican voting base, because the people who are a part of that extremist movement, whether they actually vote or not, they want and tend to support Republican and conservative government. And isn't that the issue? Let me play another sound of Mitch McConnell. This is Mitch McConnell. After he said before, that dude was responsible. Donald Trump did it. Here was him tonight on Fox. Mitch McConnell.
If the president was the party's nominee, would you support him?
The nominee of the party? Absolutely.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, Michael, they're worried they need those people to vote for them, right? They're worried they need the extremists, the white nationalists, the neo-Nazis to vote for them.
Yeah, they do. And that encapsulates that very point. It encapsulates the absolute fear they have that, you know, 25-30% of the base is just going to walk away from them, primary them, scream at them, yell at them. So he says that it was this bad behavior that brought about the insurrection on January 6th. But you know what? If he's the nominee of our party, he's my man. I'm going to be with him 100%. Look, I cannot agree more with Elizabeth. I wish to heaven someone would listen to what she's saying, because she's absolutely right. This is not something that just happened on January 6th. This is something that has been in the making for quite some time. And so if the Democrats are strategic.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
They will call the bluff of the Republicans to say, all right, you think everything is political? You think everything is partisan? What do you want to do? We'll do that. We will include BLM. We will include Antifa. We will include everybody. We will look at every protest that has taken place over the last 5-10 years. Because Elizabeth's right, the facts will bear out truth. And that truth is what a lot of these folks who are stoking this stuff don't want revealed. The Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Boberts and all that crazy ilk, they grift off of that lie. That big lie is how they are where they are. And so let's expose it. And hopefully in that exposure, they are summarily removed from the body politic as they should be. And maybe some of these Republicans will see, oh, gee, I guess the American people were right. We got a problem, meaning us Republicans.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I double dare them. Put Black Lives Matter in there, because we reported on this very show about all of the incidences where Black Lives Matter would hold a march. And Black Lives Matter don't come armed to marches. They come and they do a march. And then the sun goes down and people who are not Black Lives Matter, who Black Lives Matter are filming, are breaking windows and starting fires because they want to implicate Black Lives Matter to create a talking point for the people they support politically. It's happened so many times. We'll give them tape. If they have a 9/11 commission, the readout will send them some of our reports, because we report on this. We double dare you. Black Lives Matter has been a movement about stopping police violence. You want to make them responsible for that Capitol riot? Okay, they were wearing flying Trump flags. Good luck. Do it. Yeah. Congressman, the threat to the inaugural the threat to the inaugural, the threat of the potential March 4th, you know, we're hearing all of this sort of swirling around. Are you confident that the Capitol Police right now are prepared in terms of their security protocols to defend the Capitol and protect the Capitol for the inaugural and for whatever might happen in March?
I just want to say this first, Joy. With respect to domestic terrorism, I think there's consensus in the Congress that it's a serious and lethal threat to our country and that we have to do more to stop it. The Judiciary Committee is taking that issue up. And I also think that Judge Garland, as our next Attorney General, he made clear in his confirmation hearings that this will be a priority of his. With respect to the security
but
concerns,
but is it a consensus, sir?
Today,
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you, sir. But you're saying it's a consensus. Is it a consensus across parties?
Consensus in House Democratic Caucus. I should clarify. Consensus.
Okay, in the
House
Democratic Caucus. Okay.
Consensus with respect to the chairwoman of the Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Sheila Jackson Lee. Consensus in the view of the Congressional Black Caucus. I think there is consensus there. Obviously, we're going to have to do more work to convince some of our other colleagues. In terms of the security concerns, I would just say today's hearing in the Appropriations Committee, I thought, provided a better understanding of the U.S. Capitol Police's current needs and resources. And so obviously we're going to have to take some significant and substantive steps, I think, in the coming days and weeks to better support our rank and file officers during this very tumultuous time. So I defer to Tim Ryan, who is the chairman of that committee, and I think he's going to provide the broader Congress with some recommendations on that front.
Let me take a little bit of a turn. Let's talk a little bit about, because we are lucky enough to have you, Ms. Newman, on the Homeland Security front in terms of immigration. There's been an attempted rebrand of probably the most unrebrandable figure in American political history, Stephen Miller, who's now back out there sort of trying to, I guess, make himself seem less creepy and give interviews. But, there is reporting that he's trying to sort of wage war against the current president, against President Biden's immigration policy by trying to wrap the former president around Biden's policies to try to make it look like he's continuing them and to try to flip the sort of storyline on him. Far be it from us to brace yourselves for this. This was Stephen Miller. He was on Fox News. And here he was trying to call the current president's policies inhumane.
What we are seeing here is the cruelty and inhumanity of Joe Biden's immigration policies. He came into office and announced that there's an open door and that young people who come into this country illegally are going to be resettled instead of returned. He is forcing thousands of young children into the arms of smugglers, into the arms of traffickers, into the arms of coyotes. These young illegal immigrants are being put in harm's way, all because of a policy choice Joe Biden made to restore catch and release. That is cruel. That is inhumane.
That dude will never not be creepy. The Washington Post, Greg Sargent reports that what he's doing, Miller, is that he's actually behind the scenes calling on officials to collect internal information for future lawsuits, that he is calling on publicly law enforcement agents to defy President Biden's policies and running a propaganda war to manufacture the impression that Biden's agenda is already a catastrophe. He's essentially waging war because he wants to restore the anti-Brown, anti-Black immigration policies that he has snuggled up to since college. What do you make of that aspect of what we're looking at right now?
I'm not surprised. I mean, it sounds exactly like the kind of conniving that Stephen does. The thing that makes me laugh about it, though, is that he single-handedly destroyed one of the best opportunities for immigration reform in early 2018. Like, the deal had been done, everybody was on board, and it was him. It was him that blew it up. And it's so ruined the relationships with members of Congress and the Department of Homeland Security and everybody in the administration that basically it was like, we're not working with you guys. You guys can't seem to get your act together and make an agreement that you can stick with. And the idea that it's Stephen back on the Hill with the very people that really loathed him. They don't like him. And I'm not going to deny that there are probably a handful of, you know, very, very Trumpian to their core members of Congress that lap up any attention Stephen gives them. But the, by and large, the Republicans that just hold their nose and tolerate Trump, they really do not like Stephen. So if you were trying to send your ambassador to the Hill to try to make sure that your agenda is preserved, I don't know that Stephen's the best person to do that. And I mean, I could go on. Like, he's
not a PR guy.
He's not making a compelling argument here.
Yeah. And very quickly, you know, before, because I have one final question for the congressman, but Michael, you and I have talked about this before. The Republican Party is assuming it can survive forever as basically an all-white party with one or two sprinkles of people of color in it. That numerically is just not true. What is the point of sending that guy back out to further alienate anyone under age 40 who's looking at the Republican Party as a racist party that embraces neo-Nazism and embraces fascism? Why send that guy back out?
Well, you still see the influences of sort of the Trump-esque kind of environment that has been created, number one. Number two, there's also the setup play for 2022 to lay down the tracks as early as possible to categorize and box in the Biden administration around this notion that now he's opened up the borders and we're overrun by these, as you heard him use the term, illegal immigrants. To Elizabeth's point, you've got to understand why, there's that congressional play that is, you know, why would you do that? Because they don't like you. They don't give a rat's patootie about that. That's not the bottom line play. The bottom line play is the broader messaging that they're beginning to put in place to set the Democrats back on their heels on this issue on immigration. Guess where? With white suburban women. So this play is going to be one that you got to watch evolve over time.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are out of time. Congressman Neguse, just very quickly, yes or no question. Is the $15 an hour going to pass?
I think so, Joy. I think so.
Yes. Excellent. Congressman Joe Neguse, Elizabeth Newman, Michael Steele, thank you all very much. Coming up on The Readout, the report on the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi won't just implicate the Saudi crown prince. It will also help expose the thoroughly corrupt Trump Kushner Mnuchin relationships in that part of the world. Plus, Ted Cancun Cruz is very concerned tonight, not about providing COVID relief or about the freezing constituents he abandoned. No, no. He and other Republicans are concerned about Mr. Potato Head. Mm-hmm. Yes, the kid's toy, which is dropping the Mr. from its brand name. Oh, Ted, despite your uncanny resemblance to the Potato Head and your bigotry about gender identity, you, sir, are still not the absolute worst. But we know you'll keep trying. The big reveal on who outworsted Cancun Cruz tonight is coming up. And be sure to join us tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern for a special edition of The Readout on the racial disparities in the COVID crisis. The Readout continues after this. The Biden administration is planning to release an intelligence report that concludes that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly approved the killing of Jamal Khashoggi back in 2018. The journalist for The Washington Post, who had openly criticized the Saudi Arabian government, was lured to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and murdered by a team of intelligence operatives with close ties to the Crown Prince. The Saudi government originally denied the murder and then claimed it was an accident. An accident apparently involving a bone saw. We've known that the Crown Prince was directly responsible for Khashoggi's murder for more than 2 years now, but the release of the report marks a big shift in policy. Until recently, we had a president, one very focused on the money Saudi Arabia spent on U.S. weapons, who refused to openly acknowledge MBS's involvement. Instead of speaking out against this blatant human rights violation against an American resident, our former president released a statement titled Standing with Saudi Arabia, where he noted that, quote, the world is a very dangerous place, and concluding that it could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. Candidate Biden had a very different take.
I would make it very clear. We were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
Late today, the White House announced that that President Biden spoke with Saudi Arabia's king, bin Salman's father. The readout of the call does not explicitly mention Khashoggi, but said that Biden affirmed the importance of the United States placed on universal human rights and the rule of law. I'm joined now by Rula Jibril, visiting professor at the University of Miami, and Richard Engel, NBC News chief foreign correspondent. Richard, I'll ask you first, what will we learn in this report, to your knowledge and your reporting, that is new? Will we learn anything new here?
Well, we haven't seen the report, so there could very well be new information. But I think the new fact is that it is being released at all. There was a considerable reporting at the time, and there were a lot of people in the intelligence community about 2 years ago when Khashoggi was killed. And there were a lot of leaks, and there were a lot of there was quite a bit of detail how the U.S. Was certainly convinced, had a high degree of certainty that that the Saudis were behind the murder. Because if you remember, initially, the Saudis said they had nothing to do with it. They didn't know what happened, that this was just some sort of mysterious disappearance that this well-known columnist for The Washington Post walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and never left. And the initial response was to shrug their shoulders. So we learned quite a bit at the time how the U.S. was very, very convinced that the Saudis were behind it and that MBS had to have at least some knowledge. But now to see it come out in this way, very early, one of the first major foreign policy moves from President Biden, it is, I think that is the significance. But we will see what is in the report. But the timing may be, yeah, maybe more revealing than the details itself.
And, you know, Rula, let me play for you what the former president said when he was asked specifically about, you know, the murder of this person who was an American resident. He lived in the United States. He was a columnist at The Washington Post. Here's what he said when he was asked about that murder.
They spend $400 to $450 billion over a period of time. All so money, all jobs, buying
that's
equipment.
That's the price. As long as they keep buying, you'll overlook some of this behavior.
But I'm not like a fool that says we don't want to do business with them, Chuck.
Yeah.
Take their money. Take their money, Chuck.
He later boasted that he saved his A and said, well, you know, he said he didn't do it. So, you know, he said he didn't do it. So that was good enough for me. Money was always behind this, right? Money was always behind the indifference of the previous administration.
Yes, not only arms sales. The truth is, when we saw January 6th, the insurrection, these white supremacists trying to overthrow an American democracy and install a dictator, guess what? Dictators around the world, when Donald Trump was elected, tried to buy him off. Immediately, if you remember, Joy, in December 2018, 15, at Mar-a-Lago, 20 days before his inauguration, Trump stood in front of the cameras and he said, well, I had a great offer from an Emirati businessman. His name is Sejwali. He offered to bribe me, basically. He offered $20 billion and I had to decline. That message was heard from dictators around the Middle East who start basically understanding that Trump was for sale, that America was for sale. Immediately, the first trip overseas was to Saudi Arabia. Then we start seeing every official from Kushner to Pompeo to Mnuchin going back and forth with Saudi Arabia. Then we had every policy regarding the Middle East that basically favored the Saudis and the Emiratis. And we know that there were business deals, personal business deal. Basically, Donald Trump blurred the line between his business interests and America's policy. And Jamal Khashoggi is the peak. It's basically the, you know, when we saw his killing, we realized immediately, and I hope in the report will come out, that the brother of Mohammed bin Salman, Khalid bin Salman, at the time was ambassador. He assured Jamal Khashoggi that he could go to the embassy and he would be safe. Those calls probably are heard by our intelligence. The fact that Donald Trump understood immediately that there is huge involvement, not only by MBS, but the whole royal family, who looked at Donald Trump as America's ruling family, and they didn't wield him as if he is an American dictator.
It's, you know, and Richard, when you think about it, you also, you know, I think about the close buddy-buddy relationship between Jared Kushner and MBS. They're WhatsApping. I wonder if we might see some WhatsApp conversations from Jared Kushner in this report, because he had a very weirdly friendly relationship. I mean, there was a time he suddenly disappears into the Middle East and, the, you know, he had issues with needing a big loan. And next thing you know, Qatar is cut off. One of our friends in the region is suddenly our enemy. I wonder if we might anticipate learning more about his involvement in whatever was going on in that relationship.
Well, I think that'll be very interesting to see. Will this investigation, or will what is revealed, go that far? Will it focus on attempts at a cover-up, for lack of a better word? Why President Trump turned a blind eye? Will that be part of this? It doesn't necessarily have to be. If they just want to talk about Saudi Arabia and they want to talk about what Saudi Arabia did and what information they had and what intercepts and who on MBS's, who in MBS's inner circle was in contact with the team of hitmen who had the bone saw in Istanbul, some speculation about what may have happened to Khashoggi's remains because they still have never been found. That's one thing. But if they also then focus on the Trump administration, what the Trump administration knew, what Trump administration did with this intelligence, correspondences between Jared Kushner and MBS, I would actually be quite surprised if it went into that level of detail, because it would be a much more domestically focused report. Yep. But we will see. That would be a different level of report than I think that I'm expecting.
Yeah. And before I go back, I have another question for Rula, but before I go back, I just want to let everyone know that tonight at President Biden's direction, U.S. military forces earlier this evening conducted airstrikes against infrastructure utilized by Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria. These strikes were authorized in response to recent attacks against American and coalition personnel in Iraq. Very quickly, Richard, what do you know about that, if anything?
Well, not very much about the specific strike, but there had been there has been an escalation of attacks against U.S. personnel in Iraq. There was recently a major rocket attack in Erbil, and there had been pressure on the Biden administration to respond, pressure from the military to respond militarily. And this administration, like with putting out this report, is establishing tone. It is trying to set up boundaries. It is sending a message to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia that that kind of behavior, killing journalists and then expecting to get away with it and expecting impunity, will not continue. So that's the message from this report. And from this military strike on infrastructure is also sending a message to the militias that just because there's a new administration, don't assume that things have changed and they're going to continue to keep pressure on those who try to harm U.S. personnel in the war zone.
And I wonder, Rula, if that new message might include taking a second look at the things that Steve Mnuchin is doing. He is now setting up business, setting up shop to do a wealth fund in the Middle East, which seems quite inopportune timing-wise. Your thoughts?
I think it's crucial. It's not only about tone, with all due respect. It's about substance. The Middle East understand two languages very well: power. They also understand that there must be a punishment, impunity. They understand that there should be accountability. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi started with also when Trump emboldened Mohammed bin Salman, he started sending death squads. They threatened a former FBI agent, Ali Soufwan. They send death squad basically to kidnap people from around the world. We're talking about a rogue regime that is willing to do whatever it takes. So Mohammed bin Salman needs to be personally sanctioned. His assets need to be frozen. But also we need, in order to establish the dignity of the office, we need to see if there are corruption, if Mnuchin, of Kushner, of Trump, took money to bend U.S. policy in favor of the Saudi crown prince and the Emirati crown prince. This is about the rule of law. If this administration is serious about the rule of law, then they should send a message: America is not for sale.
There are going to need to be more reports. Rula Jabril, Richard Engel, thank you both very much. Really appreciate both of you. And still ahead, breaking news from Capitol Hill on the fight for the $15 minimum wage. This is a big deal. But next, bless their shriveled up little hearts. These far-right Republicans are making it way too easy for us to pick the day's absolute worst. Come on, guys. We need a challenge. That's next. Welcome to tonight's edition of The Absolute Worst. Now, you might be tempted to jump all salty and assume it's QAnon devotee and feckless Twitter troll Marjorie Taylor Greene, because, let's be honest, she's got a track record of being pretty darn awful. Well, this week, she added to that list. Greene decided to mock the daughter of Congresswoman Marie Newman, whose office is just across the hall from hers. Newman, whose daughter is transgender, posted a video of herself placing a transgender flag next to her door in protest of Greene's opposition to an LGBTQ rights bill. In response, Greene, who believes that forest fires are caused by space lasers, posted a large sign that says, "There are two genders, male and female. Trust the science." Here's the video she posted. Yeah, the QAnon congresswoman clearly has too much time on her hands since she's been booted from her committee assignments and has nothing else to do for her constituents but troll on their behalf. You're welcome, Georgia's 14th district. The Equality Act, which is the source of the dust-up, would prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Greene called the bill immoral and disgusting because apparently being a just and equitable society is a bridge too far for the CrossFit queen. Now, most of you would think that that would easily make her the absolute worst. But no. Niet. No. Because you know who is the actual absolute worst? Well, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, of course. Senator Paul, ostensibly a doctor, appeared to equate gender confirmation surgery with genital mutilation. That alone is pretty awful. But what made this worse is that he did it during the confirmation hearing of Dr. Rachel Levine, President Biden's nominee for Assistant Secretary of Health. She would become the first openly transgender federal official confirmed by the Senate. Dr. Levine graciously offered to educate the self-certified eye doctor.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Dr. Levine, you have supported both allowing minors to be given hormone blockers to prevent them from going through puberty, as well as surgical destruction of a minor's genitalia. Like surgical mutilation, hormonal interruption of puberty can permanently alter and prevent secondary sexual characteristics. Dr. Levine, do you believe that minors are capable of making such a life-changing decision as changing one's sex?
Transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field with robust research and standards of care that have been developed. I would look forward to working with you and your office and coming to your office and discussing the particulars of the standards of care for transgender medicine.
Don't let Rand operate on you. Apparently insulting your fellow human who is trans is a Republican requirement, and that makes Rand Paul the absolute worst. But on a positive note, the Equality Act passed the House and is on its way to the Senate, where it will need 10 Republican votes in order to wind up on President Biden's desk. And you know that means we could have 40-plus Republicans in the running for the absolute worst in just a few short weeks. Stay tuned. Well, we've got breaking news tonight. The Senate parliamentarian has denied Senate Democrats' attempt to include a $15 an hour minimum wage in the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. This is a huge setback for Democrats who were bullish on the prospect that it would survive. President Biden, a veteran of the Senate, had signaled this could happen, and it's unclear what Democrats will do going forward. The minimum wage increase is currently in the House version of the bill, which is set to hit the floor tomorrow. Joining me now is Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network. And the Reverend has an exclusive interview with Vice President Kamala Harris, which airs Saturday at 5 p.m. on Politics Nation right here on MSNBC. First of all, Rev, congratulations on that interview. And, you know, speaking of Vice President Kamala Harris, in theory, she could just overrule the parliamentarian. It's happened before in the past, but we had Ron Klain, the chief of the White House chief of staff, on last night, and he indicated that's not something they were willing to do. Where do you think this goes from here?
I have no idea where it will go. I certainly hope that we get the $15 minimum wage in. I think that it is absurd to think that people can survive off of $7 an hour or $11 an hour, given where we look at the economic reality that people have to feed their families. And we have to remember people are also coming out of slowly a pandemic where they have extra needs. So clearly, I think we should do all we can to maintain the $15 an hour wage. I have no idea where it will go, but I know where I think it should go. And whether or not we deal with it in terms of an overrule or not, we must continue to struggle to give people what they need.
Does this become an issue for activists? Because, you know, Joe Biden has been pretty popular so far, and he's gotten a lot of support from across the spectrums of the Democratic Party. But, we got a statement tonight from Bishop William Barber from the Poor People's Campaign. They've been really pushing hard on this $15 an hour. He called this our economic Selma. This is it right now. And said that, every one of them gets free health care. Every one of them, as you just said, makes a lot of money based on our tax dollars. And they've never voted to reduce their own wages. Does this wind up becoming an issue if the team Biden decides not to fight this?
It will become an issue, and an issue directed at this Congress and this Senate. And it is an issue that we cannot back down. There is a moral part to this as well as a political. And that is that we must stand for people to be able to feed their children and pay their bills. And whether or not we have to keep fighting beyond what is decided since the parliamentarian has come with this, or whether or not we see something immediate, we must not ever, they used to say when I was growing up in the movement, keep your eye on the prize and hold on. We can never surrender, particularly when we're talking about people having the ability to feed their families. We just came out of an administration that gave a tax break to billionaires. We can't tell poor people to understand some protocol and procedures.
You know, we're seeing a lot of sort of gamesmanship on the Hill, which, you have dealt with presidents and trying to get policy through. On this Neera Tanden thing, now the word is that Lisa Murkowski, who is undecided on her nomination, is trying to use leverage about where her vote will go to get concessions on things like drilling. And we know there are environmental justice issues here when it comes to, raking more oil out of the ground. How do you think this is going so far in terms of the way the Biden administration has fared on the Hill, including with this nomination of Neera Tanden?
Well, I'm happy to see they have not withdrawn the nomination of Neera. I think that it is the absolute blatant contradiction for people to sit in the Senate that had a president that would insult people 20 times a day on Twitter and try to raise some things that they considered distasteful, nowhere near as obscene as the things that Trump would say about people, including me. That didn't bother them. And they supported him for president of the United States, and many of them supported him for reelection. So by what measure are they going now by someone that might say something that they felt was disagreeing with them or characterize them in a way politically, never with the kind of obscene, hateful language that a president that they are supported? So let me get this right. The president can call people names. A person can call people all kinds of lewd and rude things. And you say he should be president. She could say something that's disagreeable to your position or your stand, and she can't be the head of OMB. I think that is a blatant contradiction, and they ought to be called out on that.
And you'd have this interview with Vice President Harris, let's play a clip. You asked her about this issue of the skepticism that remains in parts of the African-American community about the vaccines. Let's play that clip.
Yes, we must speak truth about the history of medical testing in this country. We must be honest about the fact that people have a righteous skepticism about how it has been used, how it has been tested, and on whom it will be used. There is a righteous skepticism if you know history. But I promise you, and I am telling you, this vaccine is safe, and it will save your life and the lives of your family and your community.
Did you get a sense that the vice president is more concerned about skepticism or about access? Because it seems like both things are happening to the Black community right now.
She's very concerned, as all of us are, about access. People have the right to choose whether they want to be vaccinated or not. But you don't have a choice if you don't have access. There's not been equal access. And I think that she's put a lot of energy behind that. I also think she's saying that we have a choice of doing this or we can infect those that we love. Because what is the option if you don't use the vaccines that are there? You have Black doctors, Dr. Corbett and others that were part of making the vaccines. I was very skeptical. But as I started doing my own studies of the conspiracy theories, I looked at the Tuskegee experiment, which was one of the things that was in my mind. And the fact is, Joy, that in the Tuskegee experiment, they would not give the victims, Black people, the vaccine of the time. It wasn't they injected it. They wouldn't inject what would heal them. How are we going to flip it the other way around? Are we really saying that we're going to let others, whites, get all of what is available that could save them, and we're not? So therefore, the option is that we're going to play Russian roulette with our health and infecting others? Or are we going to use what's available that people like a Black woman, like Dr. Corbett, who was part of this, are we going to use that to try and affect the health standing in our community? And I think the vice president articulated that, and many of us are doing it. I went today and brought 10 ministers with me, and I was vaccinated for the first time. I'm not going to say I didn't have hesitance, but I'm going to say that I had to deal with reality.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Reverend Al Sharpton, thank you very much. We look forward to watching your interview this weekend on MSNBC on Politics Nation. Thank you very much. And we are now turning really quickly to tonight's other big breaking news. At around 6 p.m. Eastern, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities used by Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria. The strikes were authorized by President Biden in response to recent attacks against American and coalition personnel in Iraq. That is according to a Pentagon statement. I'm joined now by General Barry McCaffrey, MSNBC military analyst. Explain to us who the targets of these attacks were and what is the connection between them and Iran.
Well, Chris, a lot of this, Joy, was triggered by the death of a U.S. contractor. Another American service member was wounded, and several allied troops are hit also. They've been conducting rocket attacks. The last one was up in the north in the Kurdish areas in Erbil. And lately, they also tried to attack again with three rockets, a U.S. embassy in Baghdad. So I think President Biden, he's been around a long time. They took diplomatic measures to consult with allies and then took a targeted, limited strike against Shiite militia units in eastern Syria. They're actually not in Iraq, in eastern Syria. But I think it was a good move. It was a signal, back off if you want to reopen negotiations on the nuclear accord. You can't do it by continuing to act to attack U.S. presence in Iraq.
Well, that was actually the next question that I had, because we do know that the current administration is looking to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, which the previous administration rescinded. How do you think that something like this, these incidents, impact those kinds of negotiations? And what kind of a signal do you think the Biden administration is sending here in this early outing?
Well, first of all, we've got an incredible team now. The Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and our new Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor, these people have tremendous experience. They're moderate. They're cautious. They do want to reopen talks with the Iranians. The Iranians are playing with us, which surprised me. They want all the sanctions lifted before there are any conversations. I think in short order, you're going to see, I'm sure the engagement's going on in private right now, reopen the dialogue. The Europeans will be part of the discussions. We'll reenter the accord under some conditions. There are challenges. We need somehow to get at the notion of their delivery systems, the missile systems, can threaten not only Israel, but also as far up as Europe. So the last accord had flaws. Hopefully, the ongoing discussion will try and resolve those concerns.
Because the thing I think people worry about is the idea of sliding back into anything that looks like war in the region. That's not something we should be thinking about, right? Or worried about.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, the whole Biden team says we're changing our notion of endless involvement in small wars. We're down to a tiny presence in Iraq, around 2,500 troops. A little bit of a risky situation, in my view. NATO allies are there with us also. But I think they're going to be very careful about it. But on the other hand, you simply can't tolerate direct attacks on the embassy and on U.S. service members.
Thank you very much, General Barry McCaffrey. Really appreciate you. That is tonight's readout. Tomorrow, we will present a very special edition of this program live for the full hour with Dr. Anthony Fauci, members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and other medical experts to discuss the racial disparities in America's COVID response. Don't miss it.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.